From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're revisiting some of the best conversations so far this year, and the first is quite timely. Over the last several weeks, the House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol has presented evidence and testimony they believe reveals an orchestrated scheme by President Donald Trump to overturn the 2020 election. Earlier this year, we learned intelligence officials did in fact receive tips and threats in the days leading up to January 6, alerting law enforcement agencies. So, what went wrong? To better understand the complexities, I spoke with Mike Cena, who heads the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, among a network of 80 fusion centers that met 2 days before the insurrection about the threats they were all receiving. I spoke with him on the eve of the one-year anniversary of the insurrection about those fateful days and the hard lessons learned. Mike, if you first can share with us your backstory, what brought you into this field and when did your career begin?
Well, I started out in law enforcement in 1993, and you know, my focus is originally was vice and narcotics. Worked a lot of that. Started out with the California Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, and back in 1997, moved over and was transferred to a major narcotics task force that was primarily focused on, at that time, Colombian and Mexican narcotics organizations, drug trafficking organizations, and you know, not too long after that, when 9/11 rolled around, immediately on that day, I got a call that I was being transferred to a new organization that was being formed to kind of deal with major threats, just like what occurred on September 11th. And they didn't have a name for it at that time, but they said that the focus is going to be on information sharing, trying to address the threats as quickly as possible and improve information sharing, along with criminal intelligence analysis. So that eventually became what is known as the National Network of Fusion Centers. And right now there are 80 of those centers. In California, there are 6 of them. And each center has an area of responsibility and role in information sharing to identify threats using a number of tools. And that whole organization that we have is owned and operated at the state and local level with the support of the federal government. But it really is a conglomeration of bringing together a lot of federal, state, local, tribal, territorial partners that have created this network of information sharing that we have in the country.
With your specific lens in law enforcement and partnering with Homeland Security, what comes to top of memory? How do you reflect on what happened?
Well, and many people read the Washington Post story about kind of the conversations that I was having on January 2nd with Danelle Harvin, who at that time was the director of the Fusion Center in Washington, D.C. At the NTIC. And, you know, those conversations when he called me and was describing kind of all of the online sentiment, but more than just sentiment, the people online that were talking about, you know, bringing weapons to the United States Capitol, which are prohibited. People that were threatening, you know, oftentimes implied violence. And to the point where there was enough conversations about that online that Danelle was worried. And, you know, he's one of those people that has, you know, in Washington, D.C., they have events all the time. And, but it caused the, as he said, the hair on the back of his neck to stand up. And as we were talking, it was very early in the morning on a Saturday. I said, well, you know, what would you like to do? And he goes, well, I think we need to talk with all of our other fusion centers. And I said, absolutely. Whatever you want, we will do. And we actually set up a call, you know, on January 4th, that Monday, to talk with as many of our partners as we could. And I really expected a small number of people to show up. And then we had almost 300 people show up. And I'd asked Danelle to invite kind of his partners in Washington, D.C., to make sure that we're all on the same page about the threats that we were seeing. And ultimately, the gist of that call led me to sending out an email to a number of partners around the country about what we're going to do to try to share information more effectively. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, you know, on January 6th itself, obviously, you know, there was a lot of angst, a lot of disappointment, and a lot of concern about, you know, the protection of the DC area, and especially the facilities that were impacted, are you know, and to the threats to our members of Congress. which, you know, just like everything else we're trying to protect, protecting our legislators, protecting our institutions, protecting our processes is critical. And there was a lot of, you know, attempts to make sure that information was shared in a timely manner from our side. But once we pass information on, it's really up to the law enforcement agencies that have protection responsibility on how to, you know, use that information, that data.
We're talking about 80 fusion centers across the U.S. and U.S. territories. You said 300 people joined that call on January 4th, 2 days before. When you handed that over to Homeland Security or the FBI, what was their response?
Well, in a lot of the areas, and this is a topic that's come up, and there's been testimony about this, that from the perspective of, you know, the federal agencies, I mean, there are nuances to what they can do as well, especially with, you know, online threats that are implied. Oftentimes, you know, threats that we see online, we don't know the exact location of that threat. People don't usually post their address, and if people post their address when they post to social media, there'd be a lot less postings of social media. But we don't have oftentimes the exact address or location of folks. So when we talk about the things that the FBI or DHS may receive as far as information, they may have the information, but if it doesn't meet those federal thresholds for follow-up, they really don't have the authority. And that's one of the problems that, you know, many people don't understand, is that each of the federal agencies has very specific authorities of what they can and can't do for investigations, collection of criminal intelligence, or follow-up on leads. So if it doesn't meet those thresholds, our goal is that we get that information to state and local agencies that may be able to work within the parameters of their authorities, which are oftentimes broader in the law enforcement spectrum. But ultimately, we need an address. We need some way to identify.
But were there threats that were specifically involving or mentioning the U.S. Capitol, the joint session of Congress, January 6th, and specific lawmakers?
Yeah, oftentimes, and for those that were more specific threats to individuals, if, you know, any threat that goes to an individual goes back to that agency. So if it's a threat to a member of Congress, it's the U.S. Capitol Police that have that, along with the FBI for wherever their field office location would be, or wherever they are in the country, wherever they live, along with the local agencies. So, you know, it's a multi-tiered approach to who has individual threats to members of Congress. But oftentimes, a lot of the threats that we saw were more in general, not specific to, I'm going to go out and storm the castle. It was more, I'm going to DC, I'm going to bring weapons, and we're going to start whatever we're going to start. But not specific to an act of violence that a person was going to do, but reading into it and looking through the data, there was a lot of implications that there was something bad that was going to happen.
Given that on January 4th, just 2 days prior, you organized that conference call with regional intelligence centers, and yet 300 people join. Is that unusual?
Well, it was actually one of the first times that we've had a call like that. I mean, we're actually felt like, hey, I think we're ahead of the game here. We actually have, a lot of different threats that when you bring them together, there may be, you know, something that is going to happen that we're worried about. So part of this was bringing together all these folks, but not knowing that something's going to happen. But I felt that we were a lot more ahead of the game than we have been on other threats that have been executed. So this it wasn't something we normally do for these events, of bringing a call before the event. There's a lot of post calls after something bad happens, but this was one of the first times that we'd had a call beforehand where there was such an interest in the call because a number of people were seeing the same things around the country. But there were also a number of people who were on the call who didn't know that certain posts were being put out there online that involved their state or their jurisdiction. So we're able to connect those people literally on that call as we're happening, having the call, bringing those people together. So they knew that there were threats coming from someone in their state. At least it looked like they were coming from someone in their state. And that way they could dive a little deeper at the state and local level on whatever information they could dig up.
Given that on January 4th, you thought that you were all getting ahead of this, how did you absorb what unfolded on January 6th? What was going through your mind?
it was a little heartbreaking, to be honest. You know, especially, you know, we never know from the intelligence side of law enforcement and how we operate. Our goal is to provide information to that will hopefully get to decision makers to, you know, take whatever action they need to deal with the threats appropriately. And so, you know, at that point, you know, and I always tell people that, you know, no person that works in information sharing and intelligence realm is going to ever tell anybody that something's going to happen 100% of the time. There's a likelihood, and that's what we often say, is a likelihood that some type of bad things will happen. And this is why we believe this. And this is our counter hypothesis of why even our hypothesis may not be right. Trying to explain that to making sure that it gets to the right people. And oftentimes, you know, in retrospect, you know, some of the things that I think we've lost over the years are things like the course on criminal intelligence for the chief executive. We have had such turnover in law enforcement that I just don't feel that law enforcement in general across America from the executive level has a real understanding of how intelligence works and how to use the information that they do get, which oftentimes, and you'll hear this and have heard this probably during some of the testimony that's been provided so far, that, you know, people didn't see that as the front page item on their briefing books. And I think that, you know, that's something that obviously many of us have been trying to change over this last year to make sure that people understand how to use information and intelligence. And there actually is a national criminal intelligence sharing plan. There's a plan that's existed actually since 2003 and was updated in 2013 that unfortunately many law enforcement executives and many people in law enforcement have not read that plan.
Do you look at January 6th as a failure in response?
I do.
Or prevention?
From my perspective, I think the information sharing and intelligence was doing what it was supposed to do. It was the execution that did not go through as hard to point fingers after the fact. A lot of people are pointing fingers right now.
Yeah. What I'm hearing from you, and obviously intelligence centers and law enforcement agencies are layered and they're multifaceted. It seemed like information was going out, but obviously you have local, regional, federal, and state agencies that ultimately threats and tips and information either hit dead ends or fell through the cracks.
Well, and part of that, and I just to let you know, because everyone thinks that when you call law enforcement, that everyone in the country knows that that tip or lead came through. And there are so many silos of tips and leads. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies out there. So many silos that, you know, of I would say silos of excellence that people have their data in their own area, but it may not be shared. And the goal of the network of fusion centers is that if a tip or lead raises to the level that you think there may be some validity to it, that you share that with the fusion center. And that way it can be shared nationwide. And since what happened on January 6th, we've developed dashboards, which allow us to see threats in real time across the entire country during fast moving events. You know, it's too difficult to, keep in contact with everyone when you may have hundreds of threats that are moving at the same time. So being able to have a dashboard capability where you can see where threats are, summary of those threats, and the source of those threats allows us to better be able to connect information that was disconnected previously. Now, just because you have a whole bunch of dots on the board doesn't mean all the dots are connected. But if you don't have all the dots on the board, you can't make those connections.
Hmm. What should have been done differently from when you got that call in the early morning of January 2nd to having the conference call of January 4th? What would you have wanted to be done differently?
I wish, and we didn't have it at the time, but I wish we had that dashboard capability up and running. I wish that we had, and I've mentioned this to Congress also, I wish that our technology that we currently have was modernized. We were using very old technology to communicate in a way that nobody actually really communicates anymore. So I wish we had that. The other component of that is I wish that we had that follow-up with the executives to make sure that that they got the briefing from the people that had all the information. And I think that, you know, if we could have, you know, changed the way things happened prior to January 6th, it would have been to make sure that that analyst that had that full picture was able to directly brief each of the executives. You've got to have a good intelligence section, but you also have to be able to share information quickly. And that's the one thing that the 9/11 Commission, this idea of horizontally sharing information with all the people that have a need and right to know the information is critical. And that's something that we still stumble with across America.
In your opinion, why were local and federal law enforcement agencies in the D.C. area seemingly unprepared for the attack at the Capitol when your intelligence center, many more across the country, raised concerns days before the attacks? And as you're watching it unfold from California.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give you an opinion and to criticize anyone for the actions that they took. I will say that everyone has a piece of the problem and a piece of the solution. So I couldn't really say, if this agency or that agency had done this or that differently. But I do think that if you start off with a foundation that everyone agrees that information sharing is one of the most critical things that we do to make sure that we prevent threats, that all the rest of the dominoes will fall in place. That if we make sure that, individuals aren't briefed, that everyone that has a need and right to know is briefed, especially at the executive level. And this goes from the top executive to the patrol officers. Everyone has to understand what the potential threats are and how to be prepared for them. But if we have silos where people are not given the information, then we have gaps that create pockets where bad guys or individuals or groups can exploit and cause extreme harm to the public. And directly, as we saw on that day, to individuals, including the poor U.S. Capitol Police officers that were barraged by the melee weapons and the crowd that beat them, along with all the members of Congress that they were, putting themselves in front of to protect them from, being kidnapped, basically, from a mob of people.
Given what was in place and what existed, I know that we're talking about learning lessons from January 6th, but could January 6th have been mitigated or prevented?
My belief, and that's because I'm in the world of prevention, is that every horrible event that we encounter could be prevented. Oftentimes, if we've got enough information, if we've got enough data, and we've got enough analysis, if we can identify the individuals that are the threat, if we can identify the target of the threat, and we can keep the threat actor away from the entity that we're trying to protect, that will reduce the threat. We can't stop every threat. That's never going to happen. But I have seen it work. I've seen this work effectively, where we have seen individuals who have been unable to execute attacks because of information sharing, because we got the right people at the right time in the right place. And that's really what our role is to make sure that we get the people the data and resources that they need to intervene on threats as best we can. So could there have been things that had been done to prevent that attack? Absolutely. But, every time an attack happens, we see a buildup of infrastructure to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Given that we're focusing and you're talking about the lessons learned from January 6th, where do you say the threat of domestic terrorism stands now? Has it increased or has it decreased since then?
I don't believe it's decreased. I think that's still one of our top threats in our country. I mean, we have seen, and after 9/11, there was a huge focus on international terrorism. But we've always had domestic terrorism as a threat to our country. We've always had individuals, whether it's far left or far right violent extremists that have gravitated towards harming, whether it's members of the government, law enforcement, the public, but people who have, been acquiring weapons or explosives and have, done major terrorist attacks around the country. And so we've got, just a combination of probably the worst of times where we have a large group of disgruntled people, far left, far right extremists. And, we always say, hey, we respect and we absolutely do respect First Amendment rights and people's right to privacy, civil rights and civil liberties. But when people start talking about doing violent acts, that's where we come in. So I think that, the threats have changed over the years from a focus on international terrorism. We shouldn't look away from that. We are constantly dealing with the threat from international terrorists, but we have a large group of people in the country that are willing to use violence to get their point across, whatever that point may be. And in the middle of that are a bunch of our law enforcement partners and fusion centers trying to prevent that and keep those folks from doing those threats and criminal activity. But we have people that are armed, and people that are armed that shouldn't have weapons for a number of reasons, but they're building their own weapons and people are selling them, like as I said, across the country. And I see that as a huge threat to the nation.
That was my conversation with Mike Cena, executive director with the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. The Fusion Center is among a network of 80 that received threats about January 6th in the days leading up to the insurrection and alerted law enforcement agencies. Our interview first aired in January. Up next, we revisit our conversation about a unique program for veterans and first responders centered on moral injury and how it differs from PTSD. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.